John Busby with a Culture Buzz, and to say that this is a conversation I have been looking forward to well before the initial path crossed my desk, so to speak, about this opportunity is an understatement. David Morrell is my guest. He is a New York Times bestselling author, and there are several Iowa connections we'll touch base on here. We are going to be talking about his latest book. It is another great one. It's called Inspector of the Dead. And I'm going to mention this website two or three times in the course of conversation, davidmorrell.net, M-O-R-R-E-L-L. You should know that by now, folks, if you do any kind of reading whatsoever. And this latest book looks like another fantastic read. I love this Lisa Gardner quote on the cover of the book. Riveting, David Morrell doesn't just delve into the world of Victorian England, he delves into the heart of evil. Ooh, I tell you. There are so many fun places to go, but our paths go clear back to my college days because I went to the University of Iowa. That is where I met my wife-to-be, who is still my wife to this day, who proudly states that she took every one of your American literature classes when she attended school there. And, you know, we were sharing a conversation, we were talking before we started sharing the conversation with you folks, and I wanted David to clarify things because he is an author, he taught at the University of Iowa, but he was not part of the writer's workshop, and that is important, isn't it?
Well, it is, just to make the distinction. Yeah, I taught at the University of Iowa from 1970 till 1986, and I wrote many novels there, including the one that I guess I'm most well known for, First Blood, in which the character of Rambo was introduced. And over the years, I received a full professorship, in fact. But I have a PhD in American literature from Penn State, and when I was at the University of Iowa, I taught American literature, principally American novels, but other things as well, and once American poetry, which wasn't quite my bag, and I had to struggle through that one as my first year. I still remember that with a great deal of amusement. But a lot of people assume that because I taught at the University of Iowa and because I am an author, that I was with the Writers' Workshop, but that was not the case. I was in an entirely different part of the building. You know, I had a lot of friends, Nance Bergeli, among others, who taught at the workshop.
And that's really kind of the rich literature landscape that Iowa City was even back then and has become even more so now. But the important thing is that there was a nurturing point there, and there are a lot of people that remember the classes you taught, my wife included. She took every one of your classes, and so it's great fun that we can watch like kind of a collective group of proud parents as you've been giving wonderful offerings to the world.
You're very kind. You know, my approach to teaching, some professors prefer to do discussion groups. And usually what that means is you can't have met more than, say, maybe 15 because the conversation gets crowded. But my view of it, and this is just a theoretical difference in teachers, my view was that students really couldn't talk about something until they knew enough to be able to talk about it, and that there were teachable things about American literature, certain traditions that had been established, and ways that American literature is different, say, from English literature, as in the United Kingdom. And so I always preferred lectures. And when I was younger, I had been in college in theater a lot, and in fact, I had a nightclub act. I sang and played the piano, and this is a guilty confession. And I had a stand-up comedy routine. I loved being in front, and still do, of an audience, and the bigger the better. There's something about it that really feeds me. I really enjoy entertaining, and I figured that there was a way to teach American literature that it could be, you know, a lecture that was also, because, you know, the connotation of lecture is how dull it's got to be, but, you know, that there was a way to do it so that it was lively. And one way I did it was I never used notes. So then I prepared the class, and I walked in, and I started to talk. And it wasn't uncommon for me to have a class as large as 250. And I'd have like three, I usually taught two to three courses a week. So, you know, in any given week, I might have 750 students, depending on, you know, which class I was in. And it was really interesting because I found that I was able to have that conversation, because the deal was when I was talking that if I wasn't making sense, if, you know, I was saying something that nobody, what on earth is he talking about, that they could raise their hand and say, what? And I would pause, and because I didn't have any notes to follow, I could easily divert in order to follow that, you know, the tenor of that particular question. So where I'm going with this is the dean loved me because they do a kind of how many teachers, how many students kind of thing, and then they divide it.
Yes.
So I was, you know, there I was with 750 students a week, where as another professor in three courses might have 45 students. So I made, you know, the actuarial, or whatever you want to call it, the mathematical part of it look really good. So, you know, it was a lot of fun. I really, really enjoyed it. And what I did was I spread the word to the law department, to the med department, you know, to wherever apart from liberal arts, to say, whoever you folks are in those departments, you're going to graduate, and guess what? You're going to have to talk to people. And if you come to my courses, I guarantee what I call a cultural survival course, so that you would be able to take out of my courses the kind of thing that people actually found interesting about literature. And, over the years, when we were talking before the recording, I mentioned that I don't hear from my students very often because they're somehow, as we get older, that same kind of teacher-student gap seems to be there. But nonetheless, the students that get in touch with me say that I was right, that the things that I taught and the attitude that I tried to give people was something that actually stuck, and that they were able to use it in all kinds of ways in directions that weren't necessarily to do with liberal arts. I get very upset when I hear politicians saying liberal arts are not useful, because in fact, how, you know, the ability to interact with somebody, the ability to have interesting conversations, isn't something you learn in med school.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
You learn this in liberal arts, and liberal arts should be an important part of every education of everybody that graduates, and we don't want to forget that. And this was the case 20, 25 years ago when I was in education, but we don't want to forget that when people graduate with a BA, they tend to pursue three different careers in their lives which have nothing to do with the degree they earned. So liberal arts is a good basis, and I had students that went on and became, you know, worked for the Today Show, or went on to become serious heads of serious publication publishers in New York. And I mean, I was really happy with one of my students went on to be a major force in television production with MGM, and on and on. And it's what happens is if you're taught how to have interesting thoughts, it'll take you a lot of places.
Well, you did it well with my wife, because the essence of what she said is, I loved him as a teacher because I felt so engaged and involved, and I learned. And she is a teacher and coach to this day in acting, which is just one more seed you planted there. This is so much fun. Folks, the website, I'm going to refer to the website a few times, filled with information. You can get information on each and every one of the books that David Morrell has written, davidmorrell.net. And we've been having so much fun reminiscing and talking about other things. I want to make sure Inspector of the Dead is a book that you have on your must-read this summer list. And I know you can even start early. I'll let you, okay? That's fine. but you know, what you just described, and it is relevant to our conversation. One, your books are read throughout the world. One of the most impressive programs that Steve Barry talked about, and you were part of it, was the Thriller USO tour you folks did.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah, this was very unusual. In 2010, while the Iraq War was still in progress, the USO had the idea of maybe, you know, they send cheerleaders, they send sports stars, they send rock stars and what have you. And then somebody said, why don't we send authors? Why don't we send thriller authors? Because, you know, one would suspect that people in the military would tend maybe toward that kind of book. I was part of a group of five authors, Steve Barry, James Rollins, Douglas Preston, another author, and he's just skipped my mind. This is what happens when I don't have notes, but it'll come to me. We went over. The war was going on. We went to five of the big bases, and we had, you know, just a lot of interesting conversations with a lot of service people, they really loved it that we came over. They'd spend, you know, nights with us in the USO talking about books. One of the things, parenthetically, that I most remember is how comparatively old the service members were. I suppose I should add that one of the reasons they wanted me particularly on the USO tour was that because of my first novel, First Blood, and the character of Rambo, they assumed that, you know, the service people would be interested in talking to the creator of the character and, you know, the origins of the character and things like that. And it's true. They just love to talk about Rambo. There was a lot to talk about. I think in some ways the USO tour would not have happened if they hadn't had the idea of sending me as kind of the first author with the group, as a test. And since then, many, many other USO tours, some to Afghanistan, have occurred with other authors. I'd have been glad to go, but a lot of people wanted to go on these, so we spread it out.
Well, it was a wonderful, brilliant idea. I think the whole thing came about when you creatives got together at Thriller Fest in New York one summer, and so
that's correct.
What can they say except the rest is history? Talk about Inspector of the Dead. What is the story arc? Give us kind of tantalizing details, because, folks, I want you to go to your local independent bookseller and say, I just heard about David Morrell's new book, Inspector of the Dead. I hear I can get a copy here. And they'll get a copy for you if they're sold out, but by all means, do that. But here you're going to get from the author himself kind of a quick overview of what this book is all about.
Oh, sure. And before I did remember the other author's name. It was Andy Harp.
Yes.
H-A-R-P.
I remember talking to him, too.
It's one of those things you forget a name in it. You know, he's a good friend, but, you know, stuff happens. Anyhow. I've been writing for 44 years, published author for 44 years, and I've done a lot of different kinds of books. It seemed to me that as one decade led to another and my career continued, and that's, you know, in a way a miracle, because there was a time as I was moving along when the average career lasted only 15 years. And sometimes they lasted to 20, so the question becomes, why did the careers stop? And I saw them; they fell by the wayside as I was moving forward. And some of them were, you know, I thought, you know, really, really terrific writers and exciting storytellers. So what was the issue? And the issue was that they found something early that worked for them, and they wrote. and they wrote it again, and they wrote it again, until after 15 or 20 years, readers said, you know what, I get the idea. And similarly, the author said, you know what, I do too. And I don't know if I can think of another variation with, say, this particular character. So what happened with me was that I, in my first decade as an author with First Blood, I wrote what we could call outdoor action novels. And when I, in the second decade, in the 1980s, I became interested in espionage. And in those days, it was very, very hard to get authentic information about the way spies behaved. So I did a lot of research, as I usually do. And I wrote three books, The Brotherhood of the Rose, The Fraternity of the Stone, and The League of Night and Fog, which were which mixed fact and fiction, and which were extremely accurate in terms of the history of, say, the CIA in the United States, and also the way spies behave, what they call tradecraft. And I spent the 80s writing those books, and in the 90s, I sort of lost interest in it, and part of it was, I think, because of the fall of the USSR, and the fact that spy novels were simply not popular in the 1990s. So I wrote thrillers of another sort in the 90s, and then, and you get the idea, it was as if with each decade, I was doing something a little different, and as we mentioned, my friend Steve Barry, I remember telling him that I was going to start writing novels based in 1850s London, and he looked at me. I mean, it's a shocking thought, but I think people understand by the time I'm done. But he looked at me, and he said the language was a little stronger, but he said, you so-and-so, you've reinvented yourself again. And so here's the thing. If you've written enough books set in the contemporary world, it would be fun to write something about, say, 1850s London. And the reason I headed in that direction, part of it's a very sad story. My granddaughter, Natalie, died from a very rare bone cancer in 2009. It's a disease called Ewing's sarcoma. And in fact, and we may talk about this in another context, my son, Matthew, in 1987 died from the same rare bone cancer, and only 200 people get it in the United States each year, and it is not believed to be inherited. So, you know, it was a really cosmic, crushing moment in 2009 when Natalie died also. And my daughter, you know, consumed with grief, had started watching movies about grief and reading books about grief. And one of them was about Charles Darwin's grief after his favorite daughter died. And the book is called, or the film is called Creation. And it's just an absolutely wonderful book. Movie. He basically had a nervous breakdown. And he had headaches and heart palpitations and stomach problems and boils and you name it. It was a kind of a Job existence that he lived in. And nobody could figure out what was wrong with him. The people at the time, doctors, they couldn't fit all the symptoms together in ways that we would now understand were psychosomatic and were caused by grief. And near the end of the movie, a messenger arrives. He has no other purpose in the film except to say, you know, Charles, there are people like Thomas De Quincey who believe that we can be controlled by thoughts and emotions we don't know we have. And at that, the messenger's gone, and then Darwin realizes what's going on. Well, who the hell was Thomas De Quincey, I thought. Is this somebody that they made up for the movie? But it's an otherwise pretty accurate film historically, so I thought, who is this guy? So as soon as the movie was over, I quickly went to do my research and found that Thomas De Quincey indeed had anticipated the theories of Freud by more than 60 years. And this is a quote. I'm going to say this quote, and then I'm going to give you a chance to ask me a question. I feel as if I've been talking too long here, but the quote is that this is what De Quincey felt. He said that the human mind is filled with caverns and abysses, sunless abysses, layer upon layer, in which there are secret chambers where alien natures can hide undetected.
Ooh.
And it's Freud, but it's, you know, many, many, many years before Freud. And so I got really interested in De Quincey and thought he'd written a very famous essay called Murder on Murder, considered as one of the fine arts. He was fascinated by mass murderers. And I thought I should write a novel set in his time in which he becomes a kind of Sherlock Holmes character. Way ahead of Freud, but using Freudian understanding, which De Quincey had developed, using that in order to work with Scotland Yard in its infancy. They think plaster casts of footprints is hot stuff, and he's talking to them about the sunless abysses of the human mind. They think he's nuts. And so, you know, that this would be really, really fun to write about, and just to finish my thought, and it would take me away from my grief. It would take me away from 2009. It would transport me back into a world before cell phones and before television, and, you know, before everything that's modern. And, you know, so I kind of hypnotized myself. It took me 3 years to write the book, and it's like I convinced myself I was back then. So it was a really interesting experience.
If you were a performer, I'd call you a method actor.
Well,
you're a method author.
I am, and I am indeed. This is the deal. I write books that I hope will change my life, that will move me forward, that will fill me in ways that weren't there before. And yeah, so it's a little bit like method acting. I do the research, and I become part of the world I'm writing about to an unusual degree. I have a map of 1850s London, a big one in my office, and I can get around on that map the way people can if they're using a modern map. I went with my wife a couple of years ago. I had some research to do over there, and so we were going over and we were having some fun, and it looked like we were lost, and I said, no, we're not. And I just remembered my 1851 map, and I could get around, you know, beautifully. It was almost as if I were hearing the, you know, the coaches on the and the horseshoes on the cobblestone streets.
Well, that, folks, is just a glimpse into the kind of wonderful storytelling that will unfold when you get your copy of Inspector of the Dead by David Morrell. All the information you need to know about this author, how to connect with this book and any other book he's written, is by going to his website, davidmorrell.net. As we wrap things up, I have to, since my listeners have heard Steve Barry several times, he put a nice quote on here about your book, "The finest thriller writer living today, bar none."
Steve's a good guy. It's a funny story about him. I met him about 20 years ago when he hadn't been published, and he showed up at an event I was speaking at, and he had a whole lot of my books and just smiled as I signed them, and he said, "You know, I'm an author too." And I thought, you know, because, you know, whenever anybody says that to you, you always assume, you know, the worst. And I said, "Really?" You know, I'm expecting him to, you know, say, I don't know what I expected, but he said, "Yeah, I have a book coming out from Random House," and I thought, "Oh, I see. This is the big time. He's really managed it." And I was, you know, I was very happy to give one of the first quotes for his publicity quotes for him. He's been a good friend.
Well, he's one of a very small cadre of some of the great thriller writers, and you are at the top of your game in your book right now, Inspector of the Dead. David Morrell is my guest. This is our first conversation. Trust me, folks, now that I know how to get in touch with David, it will not be our last. And I just hope that the proliferation of your writing continues well into the future. Until that time, David, much more success with everything you do and coping with life as you have. We are the beneficiaries for some excellent writing.
Oh, well, thank you so much, really.
Well, we look forward to our next conversation. In the meantime, folks, make sure Inspector of the Dead is an acquisition of yours, David Morrell's latest novel for us. Go to davidmorrell.net to get your copy. David, thanks again so much for your time. You've been very gracious.
Oh, it was fun.